As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
You are now tuned into anything potable, the most honorable, the most audible. Like Paul Pierce when he was fresh out the hospital. Like Antoine when he shimmied after shots went through.
Welcome to
Anything is Possible!
Boston Celtics Podcast here on the Athletic Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sam Jam, Packard professional sports fan. And I am joined, as always, by the kid, the god, the legend himself, Celtics beat reporter from The Athletic. We are coming to you live on a Saturday morning, and the Celtics just can't stop winning. Eventually, we're going to get tired of all the winning, but Jay King, you were there last night as they took on the very pesky Detroit Pistons, and they continue to win. They are now a game and a half back of the second seed in the Eastern Conference. They seemingly are a great fourth quarter team now, which just doesn't make any sense if you watch the Celtics early on in the season. We have the KG retirement ceremony, which will be on Sunday, and we'll preview that with looking into the great oral history you and Jared Weiss wrote in the second half of the episode. But Jay, I guess what stands out to you over these last two wins over the Pistons and Hornets?
Well, first of all, it's kind of insane that they're one and a half games out of second place. that one kind of snuck up on me. I know they've been surging, but to get to that point where second place in the East is a legitimate possibility is just insane. Lately, like the last couple of games, Charlotte and Detroit, I felt like the Celtics didn't have their best, but then reached a point where they just decided, all right, let's buckle down. And in Charlotte, that included Jason Tatum going absolutely bonkers. And in Detroit, it was more so just a team-wide defensive effort after giving up a ton of points in the third quarter. They just kind of buckled in and said, all right, let's go run away from these jabronis. And they did. And I think, obviously, Ime Udoka is happier when they have start-to-finish victories like they did for a while in that stretch. But to be able to collectively, you know, push aside a few quarters of not ineffective play, but just not great play. I think that shows growth for the Celtics that they're able to put that stuff aside and click when it matters.
Especially in the fourth quarter, though, like that's the part that feels like the biggest surprise. And I think the biggest takeaway from that Pistons game is like there was clearly like a flip that switched at the start of the fourth quarter. They're like, oh, we're just not going to let the ball in the paint anymore. And we're just going to end this basketball game. And like, can you imagine earlier in the season thinking about just like, oh, this is a strong, like smart, strong willed fourth quarter basketball team, the Boston Celtics? Like that just seems shocking.
Yeah, they've come a long way. And part of that, I think, is Tatum's evolution and how much he's grown and how well he's playing right now. The streak he's been on is ridiculous. He had 31 points against Detroit, and that was like his worst game of the last five or six games. And I think because of the way he's playing and because of the streak he's on, teams need to really, like, the Pistons were going out and double teaming him sometimes near half court. And then it's just like one pass from him because he's willing to get it out now. One pass from him, another pass to another guy, and all of a sudden, like, Marcus Smart is cutting baseline for a bucket, you know, or like it's just him playing at the level he is right now is making the game easier for everyone else. And I think you can see that in the fourth quarters. And I think the Celtics have found what works for them in the fourth quarters. And part of that is just Jason Tatum being awesome.
And he was not even like his best form last night, but it's like easy 30 points. He's on a 5-game streak of scoring 30 points or more. Like, you really feel like the recipe is there for continued success. It's just, I'm with you. I'm surprised that they're this close to the 2 seed. And at this point, it's so jumbled up. Like, they're a half game back of the 3 seed. They're basically tied with the Bulls for the 4 seed, with the Bulls having a few percentage points just because the Celtics have played 2 more games. But I don't even know if you want the 2 seed at this point. I feel like the 3, like, getting to the 3 seed with the Nets just kind of looming in the play-in tournament. And we saw what the Nets did to the 76ers on Thursday night. Like, I feel like there's going to be a lot of jockeying towards the end of the season. And as long as the Celtics kind of put themselves in a position, it feels like the 3 seed is where you want to end up. But it's just wild that it's so jumbled right now.
I think as long as Cleveland stays in 6, everyone's going to be aiming for that 3 seed. It's going to be
a lot of shenanigans.
Trying to lose games. Yeah. Yeah, there's going to be all sorts of gamesmanship down the stretch if the Cavs stay in 6. And they might not. Like, they're pretty close to the pack, too. They're just 3 losses out of second place themselves. And they haven't been playing well lately, but who knows.
But they're only 2 games up on the Raptors, which, I like, even if the Raptors are in the 6th seed, I still think people are going to try and avoid playing Brooklyn in the first round. Just that's having Brooklyn just being a looming team for the 1 or 2 seed is just feels like a wild slap in the face to the 2 best teams in the conference. Like, oh, you guys have been, here's your reward.
It's a crazy variable. And then the other part of it is you don't know whether they're going to be the 7 or 8 seed, you know, like they're going to be in the play-in tournament and you're not going to know until that play-in tournament is over. So you're not going to know, like, do I get the 1? Do I get the 2? If you get either of those seeds, you could get Brooklyn in the first round. And so, yeah, I think the 3 would be ideal. And then, no, so here's the ideal situation for Boston. Celtics get the 3, Cleveland is in 6, and Chicago is 2.
Oh, yeah.
So then
then the Nets are 8, and so then the Chicago is the most likely team to advance out of that 2-7 matchup. Because if the Nets are the 7 in that, then you're most likely probably getting the Nets in round 2. But there is a path where they could go Cavs, Bulls, and then whoever makes it to the Eastern Conference Finals.
That would be a good path. That would be quite a path.
I was talking about this.
I can't remember a year when, like, the seedings were so important. Like, they're always important. But this year especially, it just feels like there are a lot of really tough teams in the East, and then there are a couple others that you'd like to play.
Well, the thing is, like, I talking about this on my other pod, but like there's 5 teams, at least in my opinion, that could realistically win the Eastern Conference. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if the Celtics went up against the Nets, Sixers, Bucks, or Heat. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if either side won. I feel like no matter what, it's at least a 6-game series. And, like, both sides are going to have tremendous talent. And I could see the Celtics beating all of those teams. I think I would pick the Celtics in every matchup other than the Milwaukee Bucks, but that's probably because me.
Oh, you're feeling it.
Yeah,
you are.
I'm feeling it. Like, the hype is building. But I like wouldn't be shocked if they lost to the Heat in the playoff series. Like, the Heat are a very good team. I wouldn't be shocked if they lost to the Sixers. I'd be a little shocked if James Harden showed up in the playoffs because it was a big game. But, like, any of those teams, it's just like it's going to be a bloodbath. It's going to be an absolute bloodbath. And so if there's any way the seeding can kind of help you avoid, like, in the scenario we just described where the Bulls get the 2 and the Celtics get the 3 and, like, you can avoid – those 4 other teams on the other side of the bracket, that, like, that's ideal. But it's really, I have no idea what's going to happen down the stretch. It's just wild that, like, the confidence with which I'm being like, yeah, the Celtics can easily make the Eastern Conference Finals or the Finals. Like, the turnaround that this team has done is wildly unprecedented. And I've heard people as we've gotten into award season, and we'll get into DPOY, Defensive Player of the Year, because Marcus Smart had some interesting things to say after the game last night. But I've heard some talks about Coach of the Year, and Monty Williams is getting a lot of love. Bickerstaff's getting a lot of love, as they should. But what, like, do you think Ime has any chance at that award or deserves that award? Because I think, given, like, how wild this turnaround has been, like, you have to give him some, a lot of credit for that. But then I was listening to our main man, Timmy Bontemps, saying, he's like, you can't start off the season so poorly and then get the award. And I just thought that was a bit of a poppycock argument. He started off in his first year, things struggled, and now he's turned it around midseason. That's a hell of a coaching job.
I think two things can be true. One, it's a heck of a coaching job. And especially because he was really hard on the guys, and he still got buy-in. And he eventually reached the team's best players, and helped transform the way the Celtics were playing. I also think that he's been a quick learner, but some of the decisions early in the season, whether it was, you know, closing with Dennis Schroeder, playing him 30 plus minutes consistently, running stuff that wasn't necessarily conducive to good basketball in crunch time. I think a lot of that stuff also weighs into the equation. And if you're judging the best coach of the year, like, I think that should be held against Ime versus.
But he did all that stuff, and he's only a game and a half back of the 2 seed. Like, the only argument I can accept is
what about Spoelstra in the 1?
He didn't go through any of that adversity, and he's only 4 games up on the Celtics.
Why didn't he?
Heat culture.
Super hurt. They've been super hurt. They've been like, their best 4 players have barely played together all season. So I do feel like Ime deserves credit for sure. And especially because, you know, it's not easy to get guys to break habits and to break through and to change their playing style. But
I think it's more impressive doing it in your first year as a head coach at all. Like, I think that's where I think of giving Ime the most credit is, one, the Celtics in their turnaround have just been absolutely absurd. Just their record, like how they're playing now, is wild. But, like, to do it in your first year and not have anything to, like, lean on or experiences to use, I think is impressive. Obviously, Spoelstra, given what Miami's health situation has been impressive, but he's also been doing it for over a decade now. And, like, I don't know, I'm also clearly biased in this scenario.
So are we grading on a curve now for Coach of the Year?
I mean, all of these, yeah, it's all about narrative. I think clearly the real answer is just Monty Williams, because no one saw the Suns going to be winning more than like 60 games. But I don't know. How do you evaluate Coach of the Year? It's the only award that feels more kind of subjective would be Defensive Player of the Year. And Marcus Smart, I love him and I trust him. has an opinion on the issue, although despite saying he's only about winning and that only cares about winning and not individual accolades, seems to care a little bit about this individual accolade. What did he say after the Pistons game?
Yeah, so basically he said he doesn't know why it's so hard for a guard to win the Defensive Player of the Year award. And I think Gary Payton was the last guard to win it in 1996. So it's been a long, long time since a guard won. And he said the other part that was caught my eye was that he said he and Rob Williams are on the best defensive team in the league and are not even in the discussion. And so he feels like it's just a popularity contest, which it is a popularity contest to some extent. It takes into account reputation and all that stuff, because honestly, people don't know enough about defense and people don't watch defense closely enough. And, you know, defense is so difficult to measure because you have to define a single guy's impact when so many things, including scheme, teammates around you, everything else, goes into how effective you are as a defender. For me, I do think that several Celtics should be in consideration for the all-defensive team. Like, you look at their numbers as a team, and especially the numbers with their starting lineup, just been ridiculous. I kind of think that Al Horford should be like, what the hell, Smart? why are you putting just you and Rob Williams in there? I've been pretty pivotal to this defense as well. And I know Rob Williams gets a lot of the credit for being like the roving free safety guy.
But he's only able to do that because Al Horford's taking on the direct matchup of all the big guys.
Yeah, and also switching out onto guards like Ja Morant and Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant on a regular basis, no matter who the Celtics play at the age of 35. Like, Horford has been defensively just super, super important to the Celtics. But that's why I think it's kind of difficult to gauge who deserves the most credit for their defensive success, because what really has made them so difficult, I think, is they've got legitimately four guys who are probably in the top 20-ish of defenders this season, and I don't know exactly what the number is, but you're
including Tatum in that?
Yeah, Tatum too. And those guys have all been defending at an extremely high level. And then you throw Jalen in there, who, at least when he's locked in, and he's been locked in a lot this season, like, he's extremely effective too. So, like, it's hard to say who's the most important player in that mix. Robert Williams thinks it's just Marcus Smart. he said Smart's his choice for Defensive Player of the Year. But how do you judge?
Also disrespecting Al Horford.
Yeah, everybody's disrespecting Al Horford. Somebody's got to give Al Horford his respect. We will give Al Horford his respect because he's been awesome on a regular basis, and his versatility and his size at the power forward position. I didn't think coming into the season, I didn't know at least whether he'd be able to handle power forward, because maybe I was just scarred from the Daniel Tice, Tristan Thompson duo.
As we all were.
But it had been a while since Horford had played high-level basketball for a good team. And no, he's more than capable of it. He's actually been a huge key to allow the Celtics to be monster and have a lot of size and still be one of the most switchy teams in the league, which is very difficult. Like, to have that much size in the front court and still be that switchy is extremely rare. And that's what's helped differentiate the Celtics. And Horford is a huge part of that. So it's hard to say where one player's impact begins and another player's end. I just know the Celtics defense, when they're locked in, it's like they reach another level. And we saw that against the Pistons. Like, the Pistons just stopped scoring. They went more than 12 minutes without a field goal in from late in the third quarter to the last 30 seconds of the fourth. Like the Celtics, they just have another gear this year defensively when they really dig deep.
Yeah, the thing about defensive player of the year, it normally goes to a big man. And like we've seen Rudy Gobert win it three of the last 4 years. And it's like kind of difficult because I know it's very hard to one capture defense analytically, but like all defensive metrics say Rudy Gobert is great. But I know all those metrics also kind of like reward defensive rebounding. But it's weird because like the Jazz defense is all predicated on like funneling the ball towards Gobert. And so like obviously he's going to look the best. But I heard this, Pat Bev actually made this argument on JJ Redick's podcast. And it's a reason why he was obviously talking about how he should be in contention for Defensive Player of the Year, but just guards in general. And I think something that works in Smart's favor and maybe in Al Horford's favor, like someone like a big man like Robert Williams or Rudy Gobert, they're not going to be like consistently matched up against the other team's best player, especially on the wing. Like Rudy Gobert, if he gets called out on perimeter, like that's probably a loss for the Jazz. Robert Williams, I think he's had some moments blocking shots or guarding Julius Randle, but that, like that's just not his strong suit. I think like that's what you would give like the most, I guess, credit to Marcus Smart is he's automatically. Even if the guy's a bit, like, I don't think he's going to guard Joel Embiid, but if anyone's kind of smaller than that, you put Marcus Smart on him. I think the thing that's tough is that with this, how much the Celtics switch, there's no, like, it's not like Marcus Smart's following around one guy and shutting him down for an entire game, and just with how many ball screens there is, it's just like, it's a team thing, it's a team concept, and I think at this point, you kind of get punished for having the best team defense in the league, because if you have three Defensive Player of the Year candidates, do you really have one? Like, there's really, it's hard to kind of give credit to only one guy when it's like been their team switching scheme that has been kind of the reason for their success.
And I think that's why Rudy Gobert gets and deserves a lot of credit, especially during the regular season, is because they are not loaded with high level defenders everywhere. And they still normally have a very good defense. And if you take Rudy Gobert away from that defense, it's not nearly close. Whereas you take probably any one of the Celtics away from that defense, and they still have a legitimate defense. Like, they're still one of the better defensive teams in the league because they just have a lot of defensive depth. But yeah, and you know, Smart is, at least at the guard position, probably at any position, just one of the most versatile guys, because like you said, he can guard bigs in the post, and he can guard Ja Morant, he can guard anyone. And that's hugely beneficial. That's what really helps win playoff games. So I mean Defensive Player of the Year award is always, it's always weird. And I don't think a lot of people are very good judges of who's the best defender in the league. But I know like the Celtics have a lot of very high level defenders, and Smart and Robert Williams and Tatum and Horford and Jaylen Brown. Like, good luck scoring against those guys when they're together. they're giving up 92 points per 100 possessions this year. It's just insane the level of defense that they've played with their first unit. So I mean, I don't know if anyone will eclipse Rudy Gobert this season again for Defensive Player of the Year award.
Oh no, they're not going to vote for him. Everyone's sick of giving him the Defensive Player of the Year.
You think so?
I am personally. I don't think we'll get it.
Who do you think will get it? It's funny. Smart said he and Rob don't get discussed because I feel like no one's just discussed the Defensive Player of the Year award in general.
I feel like the discussion of the award just like started this week, just because it's like award seasons. But I don't, like, Draymond had it. I don't know. It's probably just going to be Rudy by default.
It would have been Draymond if he'd stayed healthy.
I think Bam has a chance at winning it, and then that's about
it. How many games did he miss, though?
I mean, didn't Rudy miss a bunch of games too?
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Do you know if the all defensive teams like have position requirements? Because it's going to be interesting to see if Robert Williams even makes both those teams. If it's just restricted to center, and we just talked about Gobert and Bam maybe being first team and second team, it's kind of wild to talk about Robert Williams not making an all NBA defense team. Oh, I guess I'm looking at last year, and Bam and Joel made the second team. So it seems like positions matter a little bit less for those, but I don't know exactly how it works. It's all kind of made up.
Yeah, I'm looking right now, and I'm not sure how that works. The year before, Brooke Lopez and Bam Adebayo were both on second team, but it's possible Adebayo is just considered a power forward or center for the voting. I'm not sure exactly how it works, honestly.
Yeah. All right. Before we get to talking about the
how would you rank the Celtics defenders if you had to rank? This is again very subjective and probably not at all helpful, but it's
smart one. I don't know. You kind of talked me into Al Horford a little bit. Smart, Time Lord Horford, Tatum, Derek White, Grant Williams, Jaylen Brown, Peyton Pritchard. Top eight. You weren't ready for a top eight rankings.
I wasn't ready for the top eight rankings. That's why Packers one of the best to do it.
What about you? Where, like, how do you?
This was not a question for me. It was just a question for you.
Okay.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day, or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to michelobultra.com/courtside to learn more.
Okay, that's a fair point. All right, before we get to some KG talk, talking about the oral history you wrote, let's go to the phone lines, those waiting in this live room right now. We'll go to Joshua B. right now. Joshua, thanks for joining us on Anything Is Potable.
Thank God. Okay, I don't understand. First off, I've been listening all week to The Athletic, to Bill Simmons, to The Ringer, to ESPN. And for whatever reason, and I'm genuinely asking you this question, J. King, how is nobody connecting the dots that Boston beat Brooklyn and Brooklyn beat Philadelphia? Because I'll tell you what everybody is connecting.
That's some transitive property right there. That's some high-quality transitive property.
Never mind that we've won. I don't even know what our record is over the last 25 games. I think it's something ridiculous, like 21-4. But forget all that. Let's just go with the idea that the Brooklyn Nets were fouling us desperately to, like, come back in their game on ABC. Everybody celebrates that. And immediately, all we're doing is looking, you know, passionately waiting for the dud of the century in the Philadelphia Sixers versus the Brooklyn Nets. That was the boringest game that I've ever seen, I don't know, maybe in my whole life. And all it illustrates, the whole thing that's illustrated, is that we have the ultimate advantage against either team, because James Harden is not going to show up for the playoffs. And if we do get the Brooklyn Nets, suppose we do get the Brooklyn Nets, the big scary Brooklyn Nets, Kyrie Irving is going to call for a switch on Jason Tatum, because Kyrie has this amazing belief that he can guard anybody. He did it against Giannis. He did it against Durant when he was with us. He'll do it against LeBron, and he'll do it against Jason Tatum, because Jason Tatum lit him up for 50 points. You have Kevin Durant on the other side, who has like a 7-foot wingspan. Nah, let's guard him with Kyrie. 6'1", like, this team has an 8-inch advantage, and we were lighting.
My man Josh has been waiting to get some shit off his chest.
We were lighting the Brooklyn Nets up. How do you not connect the dots? I listened to everybody this week, and nobody was like, yeah, the Boston Celtics could be. And by the way, we're only a game and a half out of the number two seed. And if you really want to look at stats, if you're really desperate to look at stats, look at our home record versus our away record. Our away record, we're around 500. Our home record, we're like something like 9 or 10 or 11 games up over 500. So, yeah, it does make sense that we would want number two seed, where we would only have to play one extra game on the road when we would face Miami. Yeah, Miami possibly has a chance at beating us. Same with Milwaukee. But all of these other garbage teams, especially the Sixers and the Nets, have no chance against us. None. Zero. Write it down. I'm done. Go ahead.
Oh, Josh, that was electric. That was fantastic stuff.
I'm just baffled by the fact that he started it off with thank God and then had nothing to be thankful for the rest of the call. It was just
he was thankful for his opportunity to give a speech to preach to the good people out there.
Yeah, I think that is true. He was just grateful that we gave him the stage. There was a lot to unpack in that call. I'm not as willing to write off the 76ers or the Nets. But the Kyrie asking for a switch on Tatum, that's funny he brought that up, because during the fourth quarter of that Nets game, Jason Tatum was guarding Kyrie Irving. And Kyrie waved away a screen so that he could go one-on-one against Jason Tatum. It's like, what are you doing? Like, why? Why not try to get one of the big guys on you? Why not go at, Al Horford or Robert Williams instead? Like, you made it difficult on yourself, Kyrie. And it seemed like the machismo of the moment got the better of him there. I'm not saying that will necessarily happen in a playoff series, but I am saying I watched that moment and it was like, what is Kyrie doing right now? So, Josh, electric hostility in that call.
I'm also like, the Celtics won that game, but it was a pretty close game and they still needed 50 points from Jason Tatum. I don't think it was like they didn't dominate the Nets 54. As much as the Nets dominated the 76ers. Now, I'm willing to diminish the 76ers because James Harden really didn't show up in a big game. And it was a lot of fun watching just the most childish sports fans in all of the country follow around Ben Simmons, boo him at his hotel, like follow around his bus all day and like pay $4,000 just to get in the stadium and then just have James Harden not show up whatsoever. That was fantastic theater. I very much enjoyed that. I do think I talked about the five teams I think can win the East this year. I would put the Sixers, this is probably crazy to say, but I would put them fifth at this point out of those five, just because James Harden has never proven it in the playoffs. And you would think that like having Embiid there, like having two superstars on the team would make it so there's not as much pressure. But man, The Sixers just got trampled. The Sixers don't have any defense, I think, is another issue for them. Like, they have the two superstars, and then they have zero depth behind it. And so I agree with Josh. I'm less scared of the 76ers than I would be. And I'm a little bit less scared of the Nets. I said, like, I would pick pretty much the Celtics against any team except the Bucks right now. I think the Heat would be a very good series. But I do think the Celtics, at least in my addled brain, which I think Josh shares the similar affliction I have, I do think the Celtics are a little bit a notch above, or at least not scared of the Nets or the 76ers. Like, do you believe in James Harden in the playoffs, Jay? Like, has he done anything to make you think he's going to show up in a playoff series?
I think Harden is one of the best basketball players.
Regular season. Regular season. What's his biggest postseason moment?
I mean, there's
blocking. Was it blocking Lou Dort in the bubble series in game seven of a series that should have never been seven games?
I'm just saying there's a lot of talk about that, but he almost beat the Warriors when they were at full strength and the greatest team maybe that ever lived. Like he had them on the ropes.
Almost and only you, counts you could, in horseshoes and hand grenades, Jay.
I'm just saying, like, to write that man off just because he lost to the Warriors, or like that's just doing it wrong to me. And there's no Warriors this year, and that's part of what makes it fun this year, is that I do feel like the East is wide open. But yeah, I am not going to write off James Harden. I think it's unwise to do that, especially when he's with someone as capable as Joel Embiid. Obviously, you know, those guys, neither of those guys have the best playoff record. But I think also dealing with them for seven games will be incredibly difficult. That said, salute to Josh. My man said, thank God and fuck everything else.
All right, we're going to go over now to Avery W. Avery, you have a tough act to follow, but I believe in you. Thanks for joining us here on Podable.
Hey, guys. I don't think I can follow that in any way. Or even begin to, so I won't try. My question had to do with rotations and minutes for the Celtics. Like, I think a huge theme that people haven't really touched on, like the Celtics' success, is that they really have gone to like an 8-man rotation, occasionally 9, depending with Tyus. And like, I'm looking at NBA.com, and it's actually not as bad as you would think. Like, only Jalen and Jason are in the top 50 for like minutes per game since, you know, January 1st. But is there at any point in time in the next like 3 weeks or in the run up to the playoffs that you think Ime will ease up on the number of minutes he asks the starters to play, or is this the way it's going to be the rest of the season? And do you think that's the right idea?
I think it depends on who they're lined up to play. Like, if they're going to be the 3 seed and they can cruise to that, I think they'll rest guys. Ime has not really been big on resting guys this season. He has not shied away from giving guys big minutes. Al Horford at 35 played 40 minutes in a game a few weeks ago and actually had to sit out on the second leg of a back-to-back after that. So I don't see Udoka like going away from that anytime soon. That said, like he really hasn't loaded up minutes on the main guys lately, partly because the Celtics are blowing teams out. And he's been able to give guys rest at the end of games rather than before that. So I think it's worked well enough so far. I do wonder if loading all these minutes up on Horford and Robert Williams is wise. I think Tatum can probably handle it. He's been as durable as anyone. Jalen playing a lot of minutes after the ankle, like not great, but again, he's young and typically bounces back. But yeah, the situation with Robert Williams and Al Horford, I think, like it, I don't know whether those guys can handle that for an entire playoff run, but we'll see.
I think luckily for the Celtics, maybe it depends how you look at it, but like the only place that they can seemingly give minutes to other guys is at the bigs. Like they have Tice who can fill in. And especially right now with Nesmith hurt, like I just don't know what the rest of their lineup is going to be. Like, are we going to get some Nick Stauskas minutes? Like,
I thought that was the funniest thing is when, you know, Jalen was out and then Nesmith got hurt. Instead of using one of those guys, Udoka was like, all right, we'll play Grant Williams at small forward, you know? And so that's how reluctant he's been to go deep into the bench. And deep into the bench is really, really bleak. Like, there's Nick Stauskas is like the only guy with NBA experience, and he doesn't have much. I mean, Luke Kornet, I guess, has a little bit of NBA experience too, but he's not going to play behind Horford, Robert Williams, and Daniel Tice. So, like, Sam Hauser, Keelan Martin, Malik Fitz, like who would you play? You know, and so there aren't many options, but I do think, you know, they'll be able to play as long as they're healthy in a playoff series. If you're not healthy in a playoff series, you're probably going to lose anyway. But as long as they're healthy in a playoff series, they can even go to seven guys in a rotation with just Grant Williams and Derek White off the bench. So I don't think it's a huge issue, the minutes, but we'll see.
The C's do have three more back-to-backs this season. And I wouldn't be shocked if Horford didn't play on like one of those legs. Like the next one coming up after this Dallas game, they have a four-game West Coast swing. And they go back-to-back Denver, OKC. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if Horford didn't play in that OKC game. And just because that's that OKC game, maybe it's an opportunity for some other guys to get some rest on that night. The following week, they have a home game against Minnesota and then go to Toronto. The interesting one, and you talked about this, but like the final three games of the season is a back-to-back with at Chicago, at the Bucks, and then they've like have a couple days off before the final game against Memphis. But depending on seeding, like especially with the Bucks and the Bulls being right there in the game, if they're in the two seed, they might need to lose some games or might want to have those teams jump them. We might see a chance for some rest. And I just think it's most important with the guys you mentioned, especially with Al Horford. It just feels like when he's had a little bit of rest, he's been that much better. And so I just think that if there's an opportunity at Horford, some rest, especially on the back-to-backs, I wouldn't see it. But it's a good point that like the shortening of the rotation seems to have really worked for the Celtics. And maybe we'll just see more Grant Williams small forward minutes. Who knows? Let's go to Brian L. right now. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Yes, sir.
Oops. Why can I hear?
That's a good question.
I cannot. My phone is freaking out. I'm sorry. I don't have a legal question for you this week, Jam.
Hello. Oh, that's okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
My phone is freaking out. I'm sorry.
Just ask
Jam,
the question.
I don't have a legal question for you this week, but Jay, I just wanted to say I love the Kevin Garnett piece you did. KG is my favorite athlete of all time, so I love stuff like that. Love the Brian Duke shout outs and that. I love that guy. And I guess my question is what is the level of concern that there should be regards to Derek White's shooting right now? Because maybe it's just me constantly hearing how the Celtics need more shooting and how maybe I've fallen in love with the idea of a shooter, but projecting out to the playoffs and stuff like that, Miami and Milwaukee are teams that are like very stout defensively, but if there's a weakness there, it's kind of that they willingly concede the three. And so I would be lying, I guess, if that's kind of not just in the back of my mind when projecting and predicting about what these Eastern Conference playoffs are going to look like.
It's a fair point. He couldn't even hear us if we told him it was a fair point. But Jay, how concerned should the Seas be about their lack of shooting? Specifically, Derek White, he knocked down a three last night. And it was like he's been very impactful without, you know, being a great three-point shooter this whole season. But imagine if he was a good three-point shooter, it'd feel like it would take his like value just through the roof.
Yeah, I feel like There are two parts to that. One, I do think the Celtics will deal with in the playoffs some defensive strategies that take advantage of Marcus Smart and Derek White not being knocked down 3-point shooters. At the same time, those guys are smart enough to probably deal with that pretty well. And we've seen the Celtics get a lot better at cutting, moving without the ball, dealing with double teams on Jason Tatum. And I feel like, yeah, what's going on, Packard? What are you doing, man?
My headphones came out of the phone for a second, but I'm back.
Okay.
Audio issues galore. Exactly.
Jesus, Packard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
But, yeah, so I feel like the intelligence there is one way to counteract that. And I feel like we saw that with the Warriors a lot during their best teams. You know, they had Steph and Klay, obviously. But around those guys, it was like Andre Iguodala, Draymond Green, Sean Livingston, guys that couldn't shoot. And they were able to take advantage of the defensive pressure on Steph and Klay because they were really smart and knew how to adjust to that. And so I think the Celtics are going to, obviously they're not the Warriors, but they're going to have to deal with that stuff in similar types of ways by thinking the game and by going to stuff that's not necessarily just like one pass away, 3-point shots. So White will shoot better. But part of the talk from the Celtics front office, at least when the trade happened, was we think that Derek White will shoot better with better looks from Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown than he got in San Antonio. And so far that has not come to fruition, obviously. So it's not a huge concern when, you know, one of your bench guys is not a total knockdown shooter, but he will probably be in the closing lineup a lot of the time. And again, if he gets up to, let's say, 35 or 36%, even that would be a big lift to the Celtics come playoff time.
I think the other thing about Derek White is as long as the ball's not swinging to him at the very end of the shot clock, if you teams are either closing out on him or he has a lot of space, like he doesn't just have to shoot to be effective. I think we've seen him do a very good job of catching the ball, making very quick decisions, either to keep the ball moving or just to catch and drive and swing and can keep the defense in rotation. And so the ball swings back around to maybe one of your better shooters. And so it's not the biggest concern. And it's like not how White makes his impact. It'd be a lot cooler if he did shoot threes. Let me tell you that. I'm not saying that I don't want Derek White making threes, but I just don't think it's the biggest concern for the Celtics. And with regards to Marcus Smart, yes, I think teams are going to ask him to shoot, but we've also seen him. How many threes did he hit against the Raptors in that one game? Was it 11? Like, Marcus Smart has been a willing 3-point shooter. Actually, he's gotten much more selective in terms of his 3-pointers taken this year. But I have no problems with Marcus Smart taking open threes. Like, if that's how teams are asking the Celtics to beat them, like, I think the Celtics can. Marcus is a good enough shooter at this point where I'm fairly confident in his ability to knock down open shots, especially if they just keep giving them to him. All right, the final.
That's fair. I do feel like the Celtics should have a lot of swing guys in the playoff series. Like they got some streaky bros. Like Smart could hit 10 out of 15, but he could also go cold. Derek White has been cold since he got to the Celtics, basically, after that first game. Al Horford, you know, are you going to get the Al Horford who shoots 36 or 37% from three, or are you going to get the Al Horford from earlier this season? So I feel like any of those guys, like being hot at the right time, could go a long way for the Celtics. And vice versa.
All right, let's go to Celebrity Caller. Live from Los Angeles, our main man, June. June, how's it going? Nice little Saturday morning there for you.
Yeah, man, under the Saturday morning, just listening to you two, man. How's it, like, my life, you know.
Things couldn't be better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's such tough. Life. That's tough to just wake up and listen to us. Like, that's a tough way to start the weekend.
Yeah, man. It's tough life out here. But yeah, I guess I had a question, but I guess I just, because you guys just brought her up, I just wanted to comment. Like, one of my favorite things about any Celtics playoff run is just the random game two or three that you know you're going to get where Marcus Smart hits seven threes and they just win, because when Marcus Smart hits seven threes, it's hard to lose. But then just on the recent run, I just wanted to ask a question about Jaylen Brown, who wasn't really discussed so far. I wanted to just ask your thoughts on what have you made of his, I guess not recent, I guess since the wrist injury, his loosening of his handles. And on a positive note, what have you made of his recent improvement in playmaking and making better reads? Maybe not from like a standstill pick and roll, but like when Jason Tatum gets trapped and he gets a secondary action, he's making all those reads. I think we saw that. Was that yesterday? I think it was yesterday's game, or maybe against Charlotte, where, you know, Tatum got double, Jaylen drove it, found Smart for a layup, found Smart for a corner three, stuff like that. What have you made of, you know, Jaylen's recent play?
Yeah, I think, obviously he hasn't been, like, his most efficient scoring-wise since coming back from the short absence he had. Now, the playmaking, I feel like he's just more willing to do it. And I think all the Celtics are. And I think, you know, there just seems to be more trust within the Celtics that, you know, when Jason Tatum gets doubled and he makes the next pass, that the next guy will do the right thing with it. And I think we've seen Jaylen take advantage of that and throw lobs to Robert Williams and throw kick out passes to guys and throw the extra pass. And I just feel like that's a team wide thing, not necessarily a Jaylen thing, but Jaylen's part of it too. And obviously, like Tatum is going to be the guy for them, who's going to be the primary playmaker, who's going to be the guy in charge of the offense when it's the fourth quarter of a close playoff game, and Jaylen's going to be playing off him. And we've seen him grow in those moments in being aware of what he should do and then doing it. And I just think the willingness is the most important part, and the trust is the most important part for the entire Celtics team, including Jaylen.
Yeah, it does feel like recently his handle has been a little bit looser and he's like gotten more turnovers, but then it's also feel like he has more assists. And I was like, that's pure eye test. Let me go and check his season averages. This year, he's averaging 2.8 turnovers a game, which is up from 2.7 turnovers a game last year. And he's averaging 3.4 assists per game, which is the exact same 3.4 assists a game he had last year. So I know you can't look at statistics alone, but it does feel like he's playing a little bit like you said, is more comfortable, more willing to use the basketball or move the basketball. But I don't know if like that drastic, like there's been a drastic change in his playmaking. I just think it feels like the Celtics altogether ball movement has been better and everyone's just kind of making the right decision making. I don't know if it's necessarily been Jaylen alone, but he's been playing well, within the team system. And I think he's just very comfortable now. I think he's taking a little bit more shots in the mid range. And again, that's purely eye test, but it feels like he's been doing a decent job knocking those down. And I think he's pretty comfortable going and getting his own shot, which I think is going to be needed, especially with all the attention that Tatum's going to get. I mean, obviously if teams double him, Celtics are going to need to move the basketball and place him 4-on-3, but there's just going to be moments in the playoffs where the game slows down. There's some ISO basketball, and I think they're going to need Jaylen to either get his own shot or make the right play and limit the turnovers. And I think he's kind of well positioned to do that. All right, we've been going long. The final caller of this episode, we're going to James E. right now. James, thanks for joining us.
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Yes, sir.
Thank God. No, I'm just kidding. I'm glad you brought up Jaylen Brown because I was getting ready to rant about him just a minute. I know he's coming back from injury, but he used to be my favorite player, so I really watch him when I watch the games. Like, I focus on him probably too much, but the guy's handle is it's almost like he's trying to do too much, be too cute with it. And it's like, you could be a top 15 player if you just kept it basic, you know? And it just seems like he's trying to do too much. But the big thing with him is, and I'm glad you mentioned it, Jay, earlier, him being the seventh out of ace defenders on this team. It's like, out of all of our top eight guys, he's one of the worst defenders. He makes the slowest decisions with the ball. He gets beat off the dribble constantly. And if he's not putting the ball in the bucket, he's really not that effective for this team. And I really don't know if he's a serious enough number two on a championship team. And I was listening to the CLNS guys last night, and they finally brought up the stuff that I've been thinking for months now, you know, and it's just, I just don't understand that anyone that points this stuff out just gets labeled as a hater. And it's almost more of like a disappointment, because I know what he's capable of. And I like love his personality off the court. I love everything that he's about, but there's just something going on where he just seems like he's in the clouds. Like he took a puff from the vape pen before he went out on the court or something. It's like, bro, everybody else is locked in and he's like two steps slow every other game. But it's sacrilegious if anyone ever brings that up. And I don't know, I just kind of wondered your guys' thoughts on it. And thanks.
I think that's probably a little harsh toward Jaylen. I think he is a very effective defender. Like, being whatever he is on the team, ranked as a defender, like, that's a ranking against guys who are all extremely smart and extremely good defensively. So I think from that standpoint, yeah, once in a while he'll get beat back door, but that seems to be happening less frequently. Once in a while he'll have a game where you'll just kind of wonder, like, what types of decisions is Jaylen making today? And I do think it's fair to wonder whether he's good enough as a second star to win a title. Because you look at other second stars in the East, it's like Philadelphia has James Harden. Brooklyn has Kyrie Irving. Milwaukee has Chris Middleton. Like, you can go up and down the list. Miami has Jimmy Butler or Bam Adebayo, whoever. Kyle Lowry, if you want to consider him second. So the competition is going to be great. And if you're judging Jaylen against that standard, then yeah, it's fair to nitpick and talk about some of this, the lack of high level awareness at times. But I also think if he goes off for, you know, 30 in back-to-back playoff games, I won't be surprised at all. And we've seen him play at a very high level in games that matter a lot. So yeah, I mean, I hear your criticisms. I don't think they're all valid or all, they're all like have some truth to them at least. But I also think Jaylen does a lot of great things on a basketball court. And, you know, you hear all the talk about can Tatum and Brown play together. And it's funny now because you look at the stats and the Celtics are outscoring teams by 12 points per 100 possessions with those two guys on the court. And it's like, okay, yeah, maybe they can play together. I do think there's like a bigger gap now between Tatum and Brown. Like last year, it felt like Jaylen was really closing that gap, and or at least at the beginning of last year. And it's a pretty big gap now, but that's because Tatum has taken just another step as a playmaker and everything like that. And I think Jaylen should be credited for, because he's cool with it. You know, like he's okay with that. It hasn't been a competition between those guys.
I mean, I think there's valid criticisms for every player on the team now. I think Jalen's like the most obvious one just because the four other guys in the starting lineup have been playing exceptionally well, but they still are like been the best team in the league in 2022 since the All-Star break are 10-2. Jalen, like, he gets criticism for his turnovers, but like in that stretch is like averaging close to 5 assists a game and only 2.5 turnovers. So it's a nice little 2-1 assist to turnover ratio. I don't think he's been as bad as James would like us to believe. I think there's like valid criticism there, but I still think at the end of the day, he's your second star. And like, I don't know, when you're complaining on a historic winning streak, you're obviously going to have some things to pick out, but I don't know. You know me, Mr. Positivity. I'm not ready to shit on Jaylen Brown right now. It's just not in my nature. But I don't know. The whole call threw me off my axis. I wasn't ready for. Took away the vibes. Let's restore the vibes by talking about the KG retirement ceremony tomorrow. You and Jared Weiss wrote a oral history of the KG era, which was just phenomenal. Some great stories in there. I have my favorite story, but I was wondering what were the big moments that you took away from that, and the things that made you laugh the most or were most interesting to you.
It was such a fun story to work on because everyone the stories about his tenure were just nuts. And you could tell from talking to everyone that those memories were just as fun and unforgettable to them as they would be to everyone else. Even some of the stuff that didn't make the story, like, is just classic stuff. One thing I heard, so one of the Celtics video coordinators, this was like 2008, 2009, he was technically an intern at the time. It was his first year. And KG asked him when they got off the team plane, like, did they give you per diem? And they weren't giving him per diem because they're not, because he was an intern. Like, that's not part of it. And KG took him up to his hotel room, took out $1,000, slammed it on the bed and said, here you go. Like, that's crazy. And it's stories like that mixed with him just ripping everyone's head off and holding guys accountable to the highest levels and then being a competitive nut job, whether it's on the airplane or anywhere else. Like, there's just not anyone like that guy. And you talking to people at that time, it's funny, like, they would all tell me stories about how he like tortured them when they weren't doing their job to the highest level, or when they fucked up and like we're having fun on a game day or something. And then they'd be like, and he's the greatest teammate who ever lived. And I love him.
He made me a better man.
Yeah. So it was just funny to hear guys like the dichotomy, I guess, between like this guy is a maniac and this guy yelled at me all the time versus he was also my favorite teammate. And like, I cherished the time that I spent with him. So just special.
He was absolutely
just a special character.
Just like, seems like a terrifying individual. I liked Brian Dew. I love Brian Dew being like, he flipped out at me because I didn't put the Gatorade in the water in the right hand. But then like something just like a completely crazy response for not having like his water and Gatorade ready. But then the end of the Brian Dew quote was like, but you know what, man? At the end of the day, he was right. I should have had that Gatorade ready for him because it's not about me. It's about the team.
Yeah. And you it makes you realize how different some of the best athletes on earth are. Like, I could never have done that shit. I never would have been able to lift guys in that way because I'm not driven enough. I'm not going to sit there and cuss people out and yell at people and whenever they failed to live up to my standard. And I think why it worked was because he was a competitive maniac himself. Like, he held himself to the same level that he held everyone else to. So it should be fun. It should be fun Sunday when his jersey goes up into the rafters and all the many of the old players will be there to celebrate.
Was Kelly Olynyk really standing at half court during the ceremony yesterday?
Oh, he sure was. It was great because it was like Antoine Walker, Paul Pierce. I think James Posey was there, but a bunch of guys older than them too. And then Kelly Olynyk was standing there in his jersey, and then like everyone was standing in a line at half court. And Kelly had to dip, presumably to go listen to Dwayne Casey give his halftime speech. But everyone was just standing in a line and being honored, and Kelly just took off for the locker room. it was a great moment. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
The absolute best story in the oral history, which you guys should all check out on The Athletic. You got, there's a crazy deal going on right now, like $1 subscriptions.
Yeah, $1 subscriptions at The Athletic for new subscribers. Sign up through that link so I get credit for it, boys and girls.
But the absolute best story, I believe it was it Jamie Young handing his one-year-old child over to KG and the baby being scared, and KG's just screaming, "You scared of me, baby? You scared of me?"
Yeah, I mean, sometimes
you got to scream at a baby.
Your baby's going to get screamed at by KG. My favorite was the steam shower, that Brandon Bass was just petrified going in the steam shower on game days because he knew Kevin Garnett was going to go in there. And if he was in there when Kevin wanted to go in there, it was going to be a bad scene. That cracked me up so much just because it was like, it's a steam shower.
And everyone needs to, like, you know, get clean before a game. Like,
yeah. But no, do not go in there on game day.
Absolutely not. Well, it's going to be fun to see KG get his number 5 retired in the Raptors. This was fun. Thanks to all. We had a lot of callers today. That was great. Joshua started off. Thank God he did, because that was bringing some wonderful energy there. If screaming on a podcast is potable, then I would absolutely have to say screaming at a baby like Kevin Garnett is potable. And that's going to do it for us, folks. I don't feel like yelling anymore. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week, and we'll continue to talk about the Celtics as they make their march to the playoffs. And thanks for listening.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.